Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is David Barron, award-winning author and former NPR science correspondent, and we're talking about his new book, The Martians, the true story of an alien craze that captured turn-of-the-century America. David, welcome to the show. It's a real pleasure to talk to you about this book.
Thank you, Mark. Very nice to be here.
This is one of those stories I knew a little bit about, but I didn't know a lot, and I didn't know how really deeply weird this story is. How did you come across it?
Well, you know, it was the same for me. I mean, I knew from the time I was a kid the very outlines of this story. I knew that one time, a long time ago, people believed that there were canals on Mars, and there was, in fact, an astronomer named Percival Lowell who was the real proponent of this idea, and it all turned out to be folly in the end, but it was an idea that had traction for a while. But I had no idea until I began doing my own research just how much this idea had traction, the extent to which the public just went gaga for Mars at the turn of the last century.
I know, people who are listening to this, you got to realize they really did go gaga for the Martians and the canals and trying to contact them. What's weird about it is this is really a story about how manias occur too. You know, you talk about tulipomania and other things like that. This really was Marsomania.
Right. I mean, it is a case study in how ideas can spread, sometimes ideas that are false, and yet take on a life of their own. I mean, it got to the point where in 1907, the Wall Street Journal, not exactly a tabloid newspaper, but one of the most conservative newspapers in America then and now, said that the biggest news of 1907 was the proof of intelligent life on Mars. Alexander Graham Bell, inventor of the telephone, who by that point was an elder statesman of American science, was totally on board. He said there was no doubt that there was an intelligent civilization on Mars. I mean, that's the extent to which this idea really took over. It was not just among the general public, but even among the intellectual class.
It's incredible the way that it filtered down through society and also scientists. And a lot of it, as you point out in the book, a lot of it probably has to do with the nature of the time period. We're talking about the end of the 1800s, the beginning of the 1900s. That was a very interesting time, and people were really sort of set to believe anything.
Yeah, it was interesting for a couple of reasons. And you know, even though my book is called The Martians, it really is as much about humans or more about humans and Earth than it is about Mars and Martians. And so, you know, I was looking at what was it about that time that made people so susceptible to the idea that there was an intelligent civilization on Mars. And it was a couple of things. First of all, you know, we remember that period as the Gilded Age, which makes it all sound very glittering and happy. But in fact, it was a very tumultuous time. Yeah. You know, it was a tremendous divide between the rich and the many, many poor. There was a lot of infighting in America over all the immigrants coming in. There was labor unrest, sometimes quite violent. There was anarchy. Anarchists in Europe were having terrorist attacks, and then in the United States, 1901, President William McKinley was killed by an anarchist. So there was a sense that things were falling apart on Earth. And so this idea of Mars as a better, more peaceful world was very appealing. And the idea that the Martians might, in fact, be our saviors, if we could learn from them how to create a more peaceful civilization, that would be to our benefit. But at the same time, it was also a period when anything seemed possible.
Oh, yeah. We're talking cars. We're talking movies. We're talking everything fits into this time.
Absolutely.
Flight.
I mean, we went from, you know, the modern bicycle didn't come along until the 1890s. Jeez. So we go from the bicycle to the automobile to the airplane in about a decade and a half. So, you know, that's just one example. X-rays were discovered, radio waves, all these forces of nature we knew nothing about. So how ridiculous was it to think that perhaps there was an alien civilization on the planet next door?
And you write that actually Earth people's interest in Mars actually goes way, way back. And part of it has to be because it's the closest planet. And even after this is over, the scope of your book is over, people are still sort of fascinated, locked into Mars. You know, think about Elon Musk's obsession with going to Mars. I mean, all the science fiction films that have to do with Martians. I love the fact, by the way, that you cited my favorite Martian. I hope probably most of the audience will not understand that reference.
Yes, right. Having grown up in the 1960s, one of the most popular sitcoms was My Favorite Martian, about starring Bill Bixby
Ray Walston.
Ray Walston, thank you, who played Uncle Martin, who was in fact a Martian, who crash-landed his flying saucer on Earth. That's what I grew up on, that, and of course Bugs Bunny with Marvel.
Oh, that was the best Martian.
Yeah, right. So, that's a big part of how this book came about, is just my own wondering from my childhood about where did these ideas about Martians come from, because Martians seemed to be everywhere back then. And as you say, even now we're kind of obsessed with Mars, although now it's the idea of we've been sending rovers there and perhaps we'll be sending people there within a decade or a little bit more. But it all really, even though, as you say, Mars, even into ancient times, was seen as this mysterious object in the sky, because it was this red roving star in the heavens. But our modern ideas about Mars go back to the period I write about, the turn of the last century, when we got this idea in our heads that Mars is different, Mars is special, and more than any of the other planets, it's this place of mystery and wonder.
It's also a time period where optic astronomy is not up to what it needs to be to decide this phenomena. The optics are good, but they're not as good as they needed to be.
Right. And that's, why did we have this craze at that time? I talked about, what was going on in society, but a lot of it also had to do with what was happening in astronomy. And by the late 19th century, telescopes had become quite good. There were some very large telescopes with excellent optics that allowed astronomers now to make out details of the Martian surface. And they could see that Mars had these dark areas and light areas that looked like oceans and continents and other features on the surface. So they were starting to create maps of Mars, but the optics were still not good enough to make out the fine details on the surface. And so we were at this place where the eye could play tricks on the brain.
Yeah.
Where we were at the very limit of perception. You could see that there were some interesting details on the surface, but the eye couldn't make out exactly what they were. And the eye has a penchant for seeing patterns where there aren't any and for drawing lines where there aren't any. And so it was at that stage that some astronomers were seeing what appeared to be straight lines crisscrossing the planet. And once one person saw them and the next person would go to look at Mars with the idea that they were there, they were more likely to see them. And so it was the eye is imperfect, the brain is certainly imperfect, and it was this penchant for perceiving patterns that aren't there that took over. And it wasn't until better telescopes, and then when we could actually send orbiters to Mars to really take a close-up look, that it turned out that these so-called canals on Mars were never there in the first place.
It was also a period where astronomical photography was just sort of picking up, too.
Right, and so...
And looking at the samples in your book, it didn't seem like they were any better than looking through the telescope. As a matter of fact, I think they would be worse.
Yeah. Well, so again, the main character in my book was Percival Lowell.
Oh, Percival.
A Bostonian who set up the Lowell Observatory in Flagstaff, Arizona, specifically to study Mars. He had a fine telescope. And at first he was drawing his own little sketches of Mars, showing these lines crisscrossing the planet that he thought were irrigation canals. But, one obvious objection was, how can we trust your drawings? Maybe you're seeing things wrong, or maybe you're drawing them wrong. And so Lowell then, in an attempt to prove himself right, helped to devise better techniques of astrophotography, to actually take photographs of the Martian surface to prove that what he was seeing was real. Now, the photographs for the time really were quite spectacular, but looking at them today, it's pretty ridiculous. I mean, they were less than a quarter inch across, tiny, like a small button on your shirt. That's how big they were, because if you enlarge them any more, the grain of the photograph would just take over. And yet those tiny photographs, he claimed, proved that what he was seeing, these lines on Mars, were there. But again, these photographs were just as open to interpretation as looking at Mars with your own eye through the lens of a telescope.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is David Barron, award-winning author, former NPR science correspondent, and we're talking about his new book. It is a great read. The Martians, the true story of an alien craze that captured turn-of-the-century America. That's one of the things that I really enjoyed is that you personally went out and visited a lot of the sites that are mentioned in this book and have sort of on-the-ground reporting of what was left or what did it look like. And I think that was amazing that you did that.
Well, I find, so, you know, this is my second book of history, science history, and I just find in order to really bring a story to life, it's important for me to, as much as possible, visit the places that figure in the story so that I can bring them alive on the page. And, yeah, so I did a lot of traveling for this book. I spent time in Arizona at the Lowell Observatory, in Massachusetts, where Lowell grew up. I looked at some of his papers that are at Harvard and the Massachusetts Historical Society. I went to France. a secondary character named Camille Flammarion, who was an astronomer who inspired Lowell, had an observatory south of Paris. I went there. I went to Italy. But the most interesting place I went, so kind of the climax of this story of the Martian craze, what really seemed at the time to solidify this idea that the Martian civilization was real, was an expedition that Lowell financed in 1907. So in 1907, Mars was going to make its closest approach to Earth in about 15 years, which meant it was going to be extra large in the sky, extra bright, and you could see it better through a telescope. But it would be better seen from the southern hemisphere than the northern hemisphere. So Percival Lowell, who was not only amateur astronomer who was studying Mars, but was extraordinarily wealthy, having come from the Lowell family of Massachusetts that made its fortune in textiles in the city of Lowell back in the early 19th century. He, with all this money, he decided that he was going to send an expedition to South America to study and to photograph Mars at this close approach. And he ended up hiring another man from Massachusetts, David Todd, who headed the observatory at Amherst College. And so David Todd disassembled the 7-ton telescope at Amherst, had it packed up in crates, carted all the way down to South America, and then he took it up into the Atacama Desert, reassembled it, and took over 10,000 tiny photographs of Mars that were then hailed as the final proof that the canals were there.
Let's talk about these canals. Let's because I'm going to want to squeeze some of this in.
Sure.
I don't want to give away the end of the story. They are really there. No. it goes back. You mentioned the astronomer and intellectual Camille Flammarion. The story sort of sounds there. He was obsessed with alien life. I mean, he really believed life was all pervasive in our solar system.
He did, and it was kind of in both a new idea and an old idea. We're talking about the 19th century, but in the 18th century, there was widespread belief that there was life throughout the solar system. I mean, Benjamin Franklin thought that there was alien life. There was talk of living beings on the sun, and on the rings of Saturn might have living beings. But it was in the 19th century that astronomy then transformed itself into astrophysics.
Yeah,
scientists now were studying the planets not just as dots that roamed among the stars in the sky, but we're trying to figure out what the physical reality was of these lights in the sky. They were starting to figure out, well, which planets had atmospheres? How heavy were they? How cold or hot were they? And so by the 19th century, it seemed pretty clear that most of the planets probably were not habitable, at least by life as we know it. They were either much too cold or much too hot, or you had gas giants like Jupiter. Well, where would life even exist there? But Mars seemed like the most likely place to find life. And Camille Flammarion definitely believed that there was life on Mars. And it was he wrote a book in French All About Mars that Percival Lowell in Boston then read, and that's what inspired him to dedicate the next stage of his life to the studying Mars, because he was convinced there could be life there.
What happened then, it was sort of a series of observations that tended to make people believe that there could be not only life on Mars, but technological, adept life. There were these triangle of lights that appeared. I think it was seen from the Lick Observatory. Talk about that. I mean, that was weird.
Yeah. So I'll go back first to 1877. So in Milan, an astronomer named Giovanni Schiaparelli decided he was going to create a map of Mars. And so night after night, he was studying the Martian surface, and he created this map. And it was Schiaparelli who first noted this network of fine straight lines that he called canali, which in Italian means channels. And he was suggesting they were water channels of some sort, but it was mistranslated into English as canals, which suggests they weren't just natural channels, but in fact were made by some kind of intelligent beings. For a while, it was joked about. Schiaparelli wasn't suggesting they were really canals. But still, there was this mystery about what are these lines on Mars. And there was a thought, well, maybe there is some kind of civilization there. And so a discussion began about, well, if there was life on Mars, how would we communicate with it? And Camille Flammarion in France was suggesting perhaps the easiest way to establish communication with some alien civilization would be through geometry. Well, we could draw a giant triangle of lights on the Earth with electric lights. And if Mars then showed us a triangle, well, maybe then we would draw a circle. And if they showed us a circle, we could very quickly establish at least the fact that, hello, I'm here, if nothing more. So he had said this. And then in 1892, when Mars was making a close approach to Earth, and at the Lick Observatory in California, which had the largest refracting telescope at the time, the astronomers there were studying Mars at this close approach, and they noticed a triangle of lights on Mars.
Wow.
Well, this just became a sensation because people were asking, was this the kind of triangle that Camille Flammarion was suggesting? The astronomers didn't think so. They thought it was probably just sunlight reflected off of high clouds or snow-capped peaks. But that really began what then was that was the beginning of an accelerating excitement about Mars in the press.
I love all the talk about and all the writing about the canals. Much hay was made out of the fact that they were absolutely straight, and that in several cases there were parallel canals, and it connected up to the ice cap at the bottom of at the southern end of Mars, the southern pole of Mars. And people just started writing stories about, okay, so they're taking the water from the South Pole and bringing it up to the oasis to the north. And before you know it, a whole story about the evolution of society on Mars was created.
Right. And again, it was Percival Lowell who was the one
pushing
this the most.
What a wild character he is. Not completely likable.
Right. He was an egotist. You know, he was from a family of privilege, and he expected people to bow to his judgment. But it was an interesting idea, and I don't fault him for coming up with the theory, because in the 1890s, again, there really was this mystery of what were these straight lines on Mars. And it wasn't just that there were these straight lines. They came and went with the seasons. It seemed that in the spring and summer in each hemisphere of Mars, they would appear, and then they would fade in the fall and winter. And so Lowell came up with what was a coherent theory. He suggested that Mars was a dying planet. It was running out of water. And all that was left of the planet's water was tied up in the polar ice caps. And you can actually see the polar ice caps through a telescope from Earth. They grow in the winter, and they shrink in the spring and summer. And so he figured, well, these lines, he said, were irrigation canals that the Martian civilization was using to tap the polar meltwater, bring the water down to its farms and cities, so they could survive on this planet that was dying. And again, it was an interesting theory, and no one could prove that there wasn't intelligent life on Mars. I don't fault Lowell for suggesting it, and it was discussed for a while. But he just latched on to it to the point that when anyone came up with any criticism of it, he could not give an inch.
I know.
And it's wild.
Yeah,
and so he died in 1916. At that point, his ideas had pretty well been disproven, but he never gave up on them, and he perceived himself as this persecuted genius. He was the next Charles Darwin, who was seeing evolution not just on Earth but in the solar system, that who would be proven right someday after his death. Unfortunately, he's remembered for one of the biggest blunders in science instead.
It's interesting because through your book, you can really see how what becomes a sort of a serious scientific interest turns into an obsession and loses all connection to reality sort of in the end. I want to mention also, as you write about in the book, there were astronomers who didn't buy this from the very beginning.
Right. I mean, in fact, the astronomical community was divided into what would be we call the canalists and the anti-canalists. You know, we see this in so much of science and in politics, too. People tend to group with others who believe what they do and get into groupthink. And so Lowell was the head of the canalists, but there were others who never bought into it. Unfortunately, it was tough to bring Lowell down because astronomers were studying all sorts of things in the heavens. And so at most observatories, they might look at Mars once in a while, but Lowell was obsessed with Mars. And so if anyone said, well, I've been studying Mars and I don't see any lines there, I don't see the canals, Lowell would say, well, you're not studying it enough. You have to look, you have to study it night after night after night because they don't always show themselves. He would say your telescope isn't good enough. Your observatory is located in a place where the atmosphere is too disturbed. You're not going to get a clear view of Mars, or your eye isn't good enough. So it's hard to disprove that the lines are there when someone else is drawing them.
He also became sort of a bit of fixated on canals because in your book there's a picture of Lowell's chart of visible Venus, and there's like sort of canals on Venus.
Yeah, so that was an early blunder of Lowell's that almost brought him down, where after he first reported seeing this network of straight lines on Mars, where, again, he was not the first to report them, and it was not a ridiculous idea, he then said he saw a network of straight lines on Venus. Well, that was ridiculous because Venus is shrouded in clouds, and it's you can't see the surface. And it became pretty clear that he was just... What is believed today is that what he was seeing on Venus were the blood vessels of his own retina.
Which reflects on the lens.
If you go to an optometrist and he shines a light from an angle, you can actually see that network. It looks like rivers on your eye. And it's quite possible that that's what he was seeing on Venus. And so after he reported that, he was really ridiculed. But he came back for a while and, again, was able to convince a lot of people that the lines were really there on Mars, if not on Venus.
Well, and as you write about, he seemed to have some serious sort of emotional problems or neurological problems. He thought he suffered from neurasthenia, which was a very commonly diagnosed problem of the turn of the century at that time, that there was too much going on and people would react to it and they would have this disorder called neurasthenia. It was very particular to that time period. He wrote some great poetry about Mars too, which is in your book, which I happen to love. Now, that's Lowell. There is a whole cast of characters that's in your book too, including Nikola Tesla, who became fixated on communicating with the Martians.
Right, yeah. So, I mean, that was one of the great fun things about writing this book. There were just so many interesting characters coming in and out of the story. And Nikola Tesla played a really important role. Now, Tesla was a genius, and he was an inventor who really changed the world. It was Tesla, along with Westinghouse, who gave us our alternating current system electrical power generation and distribution, which was better than Edison's direct current system. So Tesla, by the 1890s, was a well-known celebrity. Again, he was a genius. And he then got interested in how electrical signals could be transmitted without wires, but wirelessly, which today we call radio. And so he, along as well as Marconi in Europe were studying radio waves. Well, Tesla in 1899 came out to Colorado, where I live, and created an experimental laboratory to study how radio waves are transmitted. And one night alone in the lab, he was listening for radio waves just that are naturally produced. There was no such thing as a radio station back then. But lightning, for instance, will create clicks and pops in a radio receiver. And he was listening to the natural sounds of radio waves, and he heard this strangest thing. It was this kind of signal that he said was repeated in triplets. It was like a click, 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 over and over again. And he pondered what natural source could create that signal. And he decided there wasn't any. And he convinced himself that this was Lowell's Martians sending radio signals to Earth. And Tesla announced this at the very dawn of the 20th century. And as the new century began, this took over in the press, this idea that Tesla had received radio signals from Mars. And so that helped propel Lowell's idea of the canal-building Martians to a whole new level.
Speaking of Edison, I've never read this, but in your book, there's a book which was a sequel of sorts, was Edison's Conquest of Mars, which sounds like a Tom Swift book or something.
Yeah, right.
We're going to have to end it there because we're just completely out of time. But obviously, sure. H.G. Wells is in your book too, and a whole other cast of characters. And it's just an amazing story. My guest tonight has been David Barron, award-winning author and former NPR science correspondent. And we've been talking about his new book, The Martians, the true story of an alien craze that captured turn-of-the-century America. David, it's been a pleasure.
Mark, it's been a pleasure. I will just say one thing for your audience is that Robert H. Goddard, who developed the first liquid-fueled rocket, who in Worcester, figures in the story too, because it was that Mars craze of 100 years ago that inspired Goddard to create the first rocket. So the fact that we're going to Mars, that we've been sending robots there and may send people there soon, can go back to that Mars craze and Robert Goddard of 100 years ago.
You heard it here. You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.
Thanks, Mark.